Clearly, 7.5 million is not really enough to build the large-scale facilities that we're interested in. But actually, it is more than enough for what we're doing now, which is an effort to leverage this simulation-first approach to design what we consider to be a coherent power plant concept. We think we have a chance at actually designing the thing, but then we can go to an energy company and say, we have a full-scale demonstration of what a device like this could look like. It's called WCMX. It's not a power plant. It's not as intense as we need to for energy production, but it shows a whole lot. So with that and the simulation results and the Starfinder Stellarator optimization framework, with these elements, we think we are in a great position to go and compete internationally for the fusion race.
Ciao ragazzi e ragazze. I'm here with Francesco Sciortino, co-founder and CEO of Proxima Fusion. Originally from Italy, his passion for physics and plasma took him across the world, from Imperial College London for undergrad to EPFL in Switzerland for his master's, before moving to MIT in Boston for his PhD. Beginning of 2023, Francesco raised a 7.5 million euro pre-seed round from Pluro, UVC Partners and Hightech Gründer Fund, and co-founded Proxima Fusion, a Munich-based startup that aims to develop robust, high-performance and steady-state fusion power plants. Proxima is the first ever spin-out company from the Max Planck Institute for Plasma Physics. During this episode, we discuss his journey into plasma and different machines used to perform research, the difference between a tokamak and a stellarator, and Europe's potential to compete in the fusion race. Enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Seeders, Europe's leading private investing platform. Since 2012, it has helped more than 1,000 businesses top up fundraising rounds totaling over £2.6 billion, with additional investment from hundreds of thousands of investors. Seeders' portfolio includes Oddbox, Selma, and Revolut, as well as VC funds like Passion Capital, who have each raised millions on the platform. Their products now extend far beyond just primary equity raises, with their VC funds product giving eligible investors unprecedented access to venture capital as an asset class from as little as £100. To learn more, head to seeders.com. I kind of wonder, like, how does someone get into plasma physics? How does someone decide to study it?
You need a fair amount of masochism, first of all, and I have always had plenty of it. I got into physics in general because I had a thing for looking for the hardest things. You know, I went to look for the subject at university that would challenge me the most. I had always the sentence of Kennedy in mind when he said, we don't choose to go to the moon because it's easy. We choose to go to the moon because it's hard. And I guess at some point I was going to lectures and telling people that's why I was doing physics. Maybe I didn't actually do that, but it's a nice way of imagining it. So I got into physics because of looking for really interesting, really hard challenges. And then from there, I got excited about fusion. I am still fairly excited about it, as you probably guess. And the way to learn about fusion at some point is to understand plasma physics. Plasmas are the hot ionized matter. Fundamentally, is the state of matter in which you need to bring your fuels before they fuse, before they actually come together and make energy. So I started plasma physics first in laboratory astrophysics, so creating experiments that simulate what happens in space. And then I made some progress. I spent a year in Lausanne at a PFL, which has a machine called a tokamak, so a magnetic donut that confines hot plasma. And there I got the fusion bug. And there were lots of wonderful distractions in Lausanne. Beautiful lake, fantastic mountains. And I was, I guess, a little too distracted by fusion, on the other hand. And after that, I kept going with fusion pretty much all the way through until Proxima.
Is plasma a state of matter after you do something to it? Like the same way that you have, I don't know, like a liquid state, and then you have like a solid state. How does it work?
That's exactly right. You take a solid, you add some heat, some energy, and it becomes a liquid. Then you heat that up again, and you can get a gas. If you heat up a gas above a few thousand degrees, then the electrons tend to fly apart from the nuclei, and then you end up with this soup of charged particles that behaves in a collective way. And that's basically the key feature of a plasma. It's hot ionized matter, a state of matter that doesn't really exist so much. Yeah, it's a soup of charged particles, you could say. And it's not a state of matter that happens so much. You know, on Earth, it's associated always with extreme states, but in space it's very common. In fact, most of the universe is made of plasma. So if you look at a star, all you're seeing pretty much is hot ionized matter, so a plasma.
We had the Oppenheimer movie recently in the cinemas. So there we had an explanation what is a chemical bomb, what is a fission bomb, and what is maybe a fusion bomb. Would you maybe want to explain to us what's the difference between maybe fission and fusion, and why fusion maybe it's so hard, and maybe scientists have been trying to get to a stable fusion reaction for tens of years, and that's in a way like the golden goose. If we get to fusion, because then we have unlimited amount of energy, and if we have unlimited amount of energy, we can have this future type of civilization.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most important questions for everyone to have clarity on. So fusion and fission as reactions, they're basically the opposite of each other. What they have in common is that we're always talking about converting some of the strong nuclear forces into some form of energy that we can use. The famous formula of Einstein, E equals mc squared. That's fundamentally where we are going back to. So we're trying to transform some mass into energy. Now, fission does it with heavy uranium, plutonium. We've all heard these names. And you take some of these big nuclei and you split them. And you split them with neutrons at somewhat high energies. And when you split them, some of that mass disappears, you could say, but nothing really disappears. It's transformed into some form of energy that we can use. In fusion, instead, as the word says, we're trying to fuse things, we bring them together. And we don't use the heavy nuclei, instead we use the lightest, typically. So when we're looking at hydrogen or heavy forms of hydrogen and so on. That's what actually mostly happens in stars. You have an enormous amount of hydrogen. Most of the universe is made of hydrogen. So hydrogen, for context, is the very lightest of the nuclei that exist in the periodic table. And so in fusion, these light nuclei are smashed together and then they transform into something that is slightly heavier. So if you take heavy forms of hydrogen, often typically you get some form of helium, which is still very light, but a little heavier. But just like in fission, in this process, you've transformed some of the mass into energy. So that's what they have in common. And what they differentiate themselves from with respect to chemical energies is the density of this source. So you can think of the progress of humanity as going from muscle power, so animal traction of things, to then going through the Industrial Revolution. During the Industrial Revolution, we had chemical power, and that was a lot denser. You know, if you take a can of oil, that has a lot more energy than any muscles that I can claim. And then the next stage was going to the nuclear age. And that age we entered by a race for weapons. And yes, the movie has attracted a lot of attention. It has lots of interesting stories in that context, came first, because fission is much easier. Fission is like a process that wants to happen. You know, you take two well-prepared uranium rods, I mean enriched and so on, and they basically want to do fission. So there is a chain reaction. That means there is a runaway process and you have to control it. Fusion, unfortunately, or fortunately, depends on the perspective, is the opposite. Fusion doesn't really want to happen. It's just incredibly hard. In the stars, fusion happens, but over such incredibly large volumes. So it's very inefficient. The stars are really bad fusion engines. They just happen to be so big that some fusion happens anyway. And then it kind of powers the universe because that's all the light that we get from the sun. It's basically indirectly from fusion. So the reason why we're after fusion, having already fission, so all the nuclear power plants that we have around the world, they use fission. So heavy atoms like uranium, plutonium, and so on. Why are we not just happy with that? Well, everyone has heard of some challenges with fission. People have very different opinions about pros and cons, but fusion is an entirely different game. Fusion, we've been pursuing it for 60, 70 years because it could be a source of very clean. So it has in common with fission the fact that there is no CO2 involved at all. So that sounds pretty good if you're looking to decarbonize your electricity production, for example. Fusion, unlike fission, would not produce at a power plant scale, would not produce waste as part of the production cycle. So in fission, you have these uranium rods and you take them out and then you have to deal with them. If you could not do that, it would be nice. In fusion, the fuel is heavy. In our case, at Proxima Fusion, we think about heavy forms of hydrogen, and that you transform into helium. It's quite nice. Now, you still have the machine that has to contain this really high energy plasma. That still creates challenges for the materials, but it's an entirely different scale compared to fission. Then fusion could be very reliable. If you build a power plant and you have your materials all set up, you know, the density of this energy is so high, you could have one stellarator. So a stellarator is the machine that Proxima Fusion is focusing on. You could have one stellarator for every city, and that would make could make a, an enormous amount of energy. So we could have a source of clean, abundant, and safe energy, both electricity and process heat, and we could make hydrogen with it. That's very attractive. And maybe I conclude here by saying fusion could really complement the renewables that we all know and love, the solar, the wind. You know, nobody is saying that fusion should be replacing those. Also, solar is just now so wonderfully cheap, and we all want solar to be deployed. But solar will not give us the baseload energy that we need in our grids, the stable, very reliable energy. Solar, of course, only gives us energy when the sun is shining. You can add batteries to it. You can add different kinds of storage, but then the cost keeps getting higher. The expansion of the grid that you need can get higher. These things can work. Fusion can complement them in some ways. So I think the importance, once you start looking at energy solutions for the for a decarbonized society, it's important to appreciate that we need a cocktail of solutions. No, there is never going to be one thing that makes it all work. That's a silly illusion, I think. So hopefully fusion, we can bring it on the grid to play its game there.
I just came back from LA for the All In Summit. It was amazing. You had everything from Ray Dalio on the stage to Mr. Beast, but also we had like one track of energy, and we had, I think, like the Commonwealth fusion energy and helium energy. These are both companies that tried to solve fusion, and they've raised about 1 billion euros. As you just briefly mentioned, you are focusing on the stellarator. Can you maybe briefly describe what are all these companies around the world? And I don't know, I think they might be like 27 or 30. They all try to solve fusion, but maybe they have different angles. Do you want to explain maybe a little bit what are the differences between these companies, and why do you think the stellarator is the right way to go?
Sure. So that, yeah, there are lots of fusion companies at this point. We are probably getting closer to 50 than not. And Commonwealth Fusion Systems and Helion are two of the larger companies, both in the United States. Commonwealth Fusion Systems, or for short, CFS, is a spin-out of MIT. It spun out while I was doing my PhD at MIT. And it works on the principle of a tokamak, which is a Russian acronym for toroidal magnetic chamber. Helion instead works on a different kind of concept, still dealing with toroids of hot plasma, but they try to smash them against each other and collect the energy, electricity, with a very different process, also a different fuel. Both companies are now at quite some scale. CFS is currently the largest fusion company on the planet. They have raised more than 2 billion. So they're building real stuff. There is a tokamak coming up online in Devens, you know, in Massachusetts. And I think the CFS team is one that I know fairly well. I think they're terrific. They have shown really how to execute at speed and with great quality. We are trying to bring some of the attitude now into the story of Proxima Fusion, where, however, we are working on a different concept, the one of the stellarator, as you mentioned. The story of how I came to stellarators, having a background in tokamaks, it's centered around my move to Germany. So I knew about stellarators already from my PhD studies. They've been around for as a concept for a long time, since 1951. But stellarators used to be too complicated to build. They're a kind of device, still toroidal, so it's like a donut, but it's very twisty. And the twists that you're trying to create with the magnetic field, they require a lot of parameters. And so you have to be able to have a code that tells you what value each parameter should take. And we're talking about many tens, hundreds, depending on what you consider, thousands of parameters. And back in the day, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, we didn't really have computational power at all to play this game. Then in the late 80s, 90s, supercomputers became available. The Max Planck Society in Germany, one of the largest scientific society in the country, decided to show its muscle and used its supercomputing power to optimize stellarators. And we actually distinguish between classical stellarators, non-optimized stellarators, and optimized stellarators, being two basically different kind of devices. The Max Planck built a stellarator called W7AS, not the first of their stellarators, but a demonstration of optimization, numerical optimization of a stellarator for certain criteria. It built it here in near Munich, in Garching near Munich, and that was so successful, it then motivated the next stage. And the next stage was called Bendelstein 7X, or W7X for short. And this is a machine that is up north in Germany. It was completed in 2015. It really had all its pieces together, full high performance in 22. So right at the beginning of the story of Proxima Fusion. So I'm telling all this story to guide, let's say, the imagination to the change that has happened recently, when this now very, you know, full-scale stellarator has been optimized, designed, then built, and now operates Germany. And this kind of device, an optimized stellarator, I think, together with my co-founders and the Proxima Fusion team, that it shows many more features of what a fusion power plant should look like. A stellarator is the only fusion concept that promises to really be steady state, first of all. With the latest insights that we've had in 2022, some of the latest breakthroughs happened, we now know that we can optimize these machines to basically not have any of these historical drawbacks. So people used to say stellarators are too hard to build, and now we can say, well, we've built one, it's really amazing. It's an incredible machine to see. If you or any of the listeners ever come by Germany and are in the north, you know, you should come and see W7X. There is nothing like it. You will definitely remember the experience.
Can you share some pictures? You can send it to me and I can just add them to the show notes just to make sure that everyone gets also like the visual effect of listening to this podcast and then kind of checking the stellarators. But maybe just to summarize, then you have like all the teams around the world that are trying to build the physical object that can hold the plasma at a steady state so then we can have the fusion energy. Right?
Right. Different concepts try to confine more or less. So there are companies that try to use lasers to ablate a fusion pellet, and that's not confinement at all. We call it inertial confinement to say that it's actually not confined at all. The toroidal machines with big magnetic fields, instead they actually try to do some confinement, but almost all magnetic confinement fusion concepts are pulsed, meaning you create a plasma, you hold it in place for some time, and then for one reason or another, every concept seems to end up being pulsed. So you have to imagine a thing with incredible energy, lots of power in the magnets that has to go up and down. Now that is great for experimental physics and for tests and expanding our scientific knowledge. I think it doesn't really scale to a power plant. So I found it very inspiring where I came to understand how stellarators work, and more in particular, a category of stellarators called QI stellarators. And that was the thing that blew my mind when I fully understood it. It took a lot of patience from my co-founders and my initial team to explain it to me, because I was coming from the world of tokamaks. And this was entirely... It was what I was looking for. So at some point I was coordinating a European task force on one of the coolest tokamak scenario groups. And I was looking for this thing that would make coherent sense, that would solve the problem of disruptions of tokamaks, that would give us a situation where you would have a plasma that is just stable, that you can keep heating until you get to this fantastic dream of break even and then ignition. So the state of making lots of energy in a very continuous way. But I couldn't find that in the world of tokamaks. And the transition to the world of QI stellarators really happened because somebody had the patience to explain it to me. And then I was able to see W7X, which shows a lot of what we need along that path to a fusion power plant based on a QI stellarator. To me, the whole concept makes more sense. It's more coherent overall on what you need on that engineering scale, not just on the physics. It's a thing that looks like a microwave oven, much more. You know, a device that you turn the wheel, it just runs. It's very stable, there is no surprise, and then you turn it off whenever you want. It's just very difficult to build. The change in the story is what we didn't have 10 years ago, is that now we actually showed that we can build it. And the critical know-how for that is only in Germany.
How far away are we to have the first fusion power plant, let's say Proxima fusion power plant? What are the next challenges?
Most investors eventually ask this question. It's the most important one. I do not believe that we are going to have fusion energy connected to the grid within 5 years, nor even 10 years. Fusion is still hard, but now we're entering a phase where commercialization of fusion technology and everything that it takes to bridge the gap to actual energy production is actually happening. There is a clear transition from purely public research to having R&D in private companies, because we've had a number of breakthroughs. Interestingly enough, some of the breakthroughs are across different fields. And that's because we're accelerating on the hardware, we're accelerating on the manufacturing capabilities, on the software. As I mentioned, stellarators are really simulation-enabled devices. They have so many degrees of freedom. Now we can use them. Things are accelerating, but we're not at Proxima Fusion. We see the need for an intermediate device. We're aiming for this to be ready in Germany by 2031, is what we're targeting. And then by the end of the 2030s, we think it's feasible to build a first-of-a-kind power plant. And after that, you still, once you've done a first-of-a-kind, you need to scale it. And we're very good. We can be very good as humans at scaling things. We've done it many times before. But there, of course, comes the memory of how things used to work in nuclear power plants based on fission, which we scaled impressively fast back in the day. But also the memory comes of how that's not working really so well these days, because these very large projects in the West were not very good at building such large facilities. So we have to think about how do we create a market fit. Every company has this key question on their mind. Mm-hmm. And we have to think about what is actually realistic for our grid. How do we complement the other renewable energies? How do we make a real case that it is time to invest now? And more investors are convinced of this, hence why I'm able to follow the dream with Proxima Fusion, hence why CFS has been able to raise $2 billion and Helion also quite a lot of money. Now is the time.
I think I have like two follow-up questions. So was the spin-off from the Max Planck Institute, was it hard? You hear in Europe all these difficulties of spinning out of a university because the university wants to have, I don't know how much equity. So this is like one part, but the second one, also maybe you can talk a little bit about, you just raised the 7 million euro pre-seed round from Plural, UVC and others. And also you just mentioned that right now you have other investors joining. How did you convince them? How big is the market opportunity if this works out? Because it still kind of seems that the timeline is maybe 10, 15 years into the future.
Sounds good. So first, yes, as you mentioned, we are the first spin-out company in the history of the Max Planck Institute for Plasma Physics, an institute that, funny enough, was actually co-founded by Werner Heisenberg himself, which the physicists in the audience will know this is a name that you have to spend a lot of time reading about when you are studying physics in undergrad. The Institute has not spun out companies over its long history because fusion is hard and because it's not that trivial to create a company. Now, one of the very useful aspects of our spin-out story was that we managed to make it simpler. So we are a spin-out and not a spin-off. And we're very careful about the use of this distinction in the sense that we are an independent company. We're not co-owned by the Max Planck Society. We collaborate with the Max Planck Society. We see the identity of Proxima Fusion as being intrinsically related to its parent institute. And we want to work with that parent institute to expand. So the Max Planck Institute for Plasma Physics wants to focus on physics. Its mission is scientific discovery, whereas Proxima Fusion is instead focused on engineering. Together, we think we can go much faster with this concept of public-private partnerships that has become a little bit of a buzzword. We really believe that it's the right kind of buzzword. It's by joining this institute with more than 1,000 researchers working on fusion and Proxima Fusion, which is now a startup with, you know, coming close to 20 people, and it's has to raise to many more to build such a machine. You need hundreds of people, so that's understood. You mentioned then the pre-seed. Yeah, we raised about €7.5 million. We chose to work with European, very operational investors at the very earliest stage. Clearly, €7.5 million is not really enough to build any of the large-scale facilities that we're interested in. But actually, it is more than enough for what we're doing now, which is an effort to leverage this simulation-first approach to design what we consider to be a coherent power plant concept. That means we want to work on a design we don't think has skeletons in the closet. We don't want to bring forward liabilities like disruptions that affect tokamaks. We think we have a chance at actually designing the thing that then we can go to an energy company with this data sheet and say, here's what we actually think we have a shot at building. And we have a full-scale demonstration of what a device like this could look like. It's called WCMNX. It's not a power plant. It's not as intense as we need for energy production, but it shows a whole lot. So with that and the simulation results and the Starfinder Stellarator optimization framework, that we call it Starfinder, this proprietary software of Proxima Fusion to design stellarators computationally, with these elements and technology that has become available, I'm happy to talk more about it. We think we are in a great position to go and compete internationally for the fusion race. So the VCs that you mentioned, Pluro, UVC, HDGF, will be these were the VCs that we've seen as gaining the most conviction that we needed to get really operational, to break the mold and to create the best of what European entrepreneurship can be, leverage the advantage that we have in Germany with stellarators. We are a mile forward compared to any of our competitors in the specific domain in which we decide to drill in.
Absolutely. And I would love to applaud Plural and UVC and everyone that kind of joined you in such an ambitious journey with all the entrepreneurs that I talk to, and they come from the US. one of the biggest problems for them to build anything in Europe is because of the skepticism and unwillingness of investors to play a big bet. It's much more like private equity style, you know. I want to see that you have everything sorted out.
We absolutely have a problem with risk aversion in Europe. And in this case, the story that made it compelling to start investing and to start building this new effort was that we have an incredible story with a public vision of pushing Stellarators in Germany, also with European funding. When you come and see W7X and you see this incredible machine with an ecosystem of technology that has been pushed to the limits of what humans can really do, you start seeing that somebody has really believed in this. And Germany has invested almost €1.5 billion in bringing this online. And there have been people that have spent their careers on thinking about what may seem like minutiae, but now sets us up to actually scale this. There are a number of elements to the story of Stellarators and W7X that seem so improbable. And now we are in a condition to actually bring it to the next stage. So we inherit, let's say, this vision. And now our job is to bring it forward and kick away a little bit that risk aversion that we have in our European culture.
Amazing. Love it. Love it, Francesco. What is the next phase for you, and how many tens of millions or hundreds of millions would you need to prove it?
The next phase has already begun, and it involves developing hardware demonstrations. And the critical one on our path relates to high-temperature superconductors. So this class of superconductors that are the basis of what CFS is also doing. They have now become commercially more accessible, let's say, as the materials that you need. And now the question is, can you use these high-temperature superconductors to make the kind of very complicated coils that you need in a Stellarator of the kind that Proxima Fusion is interested in? So we are focused on designing the simplest coils that you can have for a Stellarator. We have there, as part of this framework for Stellarator optimization, Starfinder. We posted about it on LinkedIn a little bit of time ago. We have this capability of simplifying everything. Simplify, simplify, simplify is the key rule when you look at Stellarators. And then actually building this stuff, you know, there should be no illusion that Proxima Fusion is a software company. We call it a simulation-enabled concept, and we say we are a simulation-first company. But fundamentally, we really want to build very big things. And these things will cost quite a bit. They will cost quite a bit because the scale of the ambition of what we're trying to do requires coming down to earth and thinking, okay, this is, if we manage to do this, we change a market that is bigger than most companies' access. So a device, the scale of W7X, it's very hard to think that it's not going to cost some €500 million. And a power plant, let's first begin from numbers of other kinds of power plants. So a gas power plant may cost between €3 and €6 billion. Coal power plant, we're in a similar range. A fission power plant these days is €10 billion and above. So when I tell you that a Stellarator power plant would cost, our data points say, for a gigawatt of electricity, it would cost around €3 billion.
So 1 gigawatt, you can power 900,000 households. The vision here is to have one Stellarator that can power almost 1 million households per big city. And you said that one Stellarator could cost €3 billion only, compared, let's say, like with the fission that you just said, that is like 10 billion?
Yes, the short answer is yes. It's important to also realize that we haven't built a fusion power plant. And so these are models, and we have to go out and actually build these things. What we can say, though, is based on our system analysis that we're doing in Proxima Fusion, but other companies are doing something similar, we know that it's possible in principle to make these systems that deliver relatively cheap but also abundant and clean electricity and baseload electricity. The baseload bit is the one that is most underestimated by many people. So how this would fit into an existing grid complementing solar and wind, as I mentioned, these are all elements that one needs to keep in mind.
So by which year will we have a Stellarator, and in which city do you think? Which city will be like the first city to commission a Stellarator?
Our bet is that Munich is the perfect ecosystem to start this. That's why this international group of people, myself not being from Munich, I'm originally from Italy and lived in the UK and the US, you know, the story of building Stellarators and scaling them up has to start in Germany, is my opinion. And my co-founders and I, we decided that it was the partnership with the Max Planck Society that enables us to know how transfer from W7X, from other devices that Germany has been leading on. And then it has to be Europe itself as a whole has been at the forefront of magnetic confinement fusion. We are very certain that the next step of a Stellarator. So an intermediate Stellarator demonstrator has to be done in Germany to keep it at reasonable cost, reasonable speed, to really make this the success that it needs to be. Whether the power plant, the first of a kind power plant, will be in Germany, that depends on so many conditions. It depends on having the right kind of regulation, the right kind of investments, both public and private. This we're going out to try to shape ourselves to determine the fusion ecosystem. A lot of progress is happening. You might have heard of the announcement by the Ministry of Research of Germany that fusion in Germany is going to be funded with 1 billion euros over the next 5 years. 370 million of that is now dedicated to accelerate a bit more, and public-private partnerships are a key theme of that. This is very encouraging. The UK is also pushing a lot with the fusion ecosystem, and the US. The US has a lot of companies, and the government is responding with reasonable regulation that differentiates very clearly between fusion and fission, and that's paramount. Unless we recognize legally that fusion is not at all the same kind of technology as fission, we're not going anywhere. You can kill any kind of innovation if you don't have reasonable regulation. So in the US, they're moving towards regulating fusion as basically an accelerator. And accelerators have dangerous radiation, but you can contain it. We know how to make accelerators. We have them in hospitals, the small ones. This will be a pretty sizable accelerator. Now, whether Europe will go in that direction or will take a different twist, this is a discussion that is ongoing now.
Is that depending on each country? Is that depending on the European Union?
We're still trying to fully understand it. It's clear that the European Union, you know, we want to be a unified continent, and so we need to come up with rules that allow us to leverage a supply chain that is at European level. We want to ideally build these power plants all across Europe. At the moment, some individual governments are taking a little more the lead. So France has had a big fusion effort with the ITER tokamak in Provence. The UK has a really serious national program for magnetic confinement fusion. Germany is now, has been, as Tom Wilson of the Financial Times wrote recently, Germany has been the sleeping giant, you know, the clear, one of the clear leaders in the field on the public research sector, which, however, has not really spun out, has not created its champions in the magnetic confinement fusion race. And now we like to think that this is changing, but it takes a lot of work, a lot of alignment with the political players, with the investors. And of course, there needs to be the company that can really execute at the quality that we need.
You've been to MIT, you worked on the tokamak. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Then That's you've been right. working on the Stellarator at the Max Planck Institute. What was the moment in which you were, holy moly, actually, this is a better design? Like, what was the process when you decided to become an entrepreneur and start a company?
It wasn't quick at all in practice. We talked with my co-founder Lucio already when we were both at MIT. At the end of our PhDs, we started talking about where were the opportunities. We had been embedded in the story of CFS. We had seen CFS spin out of MIT, and that was a very inspiring story. We felt that the problem with disruptions was something that was keeping us awake at night. It's a liability, and we'll see how that's dealt with. But we were looking for something else. And then, as I mentioned, we met people within the Max Planck Society, and then especially a group of people that had been thinking about how to scale Stellarators. And some of my co-founders, Jorrit, Jonathan, Andrea, they took time to explain how this could work on the technical side. And we started building conviction. And then by the end of August 2022, we had seen a set of papers and new results that showed that you can optimize Stellarators numerically, get rid of the last drawback that we have been thinking about for quite some time. And then we said, okay, if not now, when? If we don't do it here, if it's not in Europe, if we don't make the most of the fact that the Max Planck Society is the key player in this field, and we are the people that can actually develop a startup and bring in that risk, fight the risk aversion, who's going to do it? And so then by the end, beginning of September or so, both Lucio and myself, we started entrepreneurship courses. Lucio was still in Boston at that time. He took a course at MIT, and I took a course with the Wilby Group in London, and we started building the story, getting ready for investors. And then the meeting with UVC Partners was particularly easy because the first letter stands for Unternehmentum, which is the name of the largest innovation ecosystem in Europe at this point. It's a terrific organization that helps so many startups in Munich, and a significant percentage of Germany's startup ecosystem goes through Unternehmentum. And so meeting them and looking for those ecosystem players was really a clear path for us. And then Ian Hogarth of Pluro, he had been looking for how Fusion made sense. He was trying to build a case for himself. He had come to the conclusion that Stellarators were the way forward. And he was already thinking about going to Greifswald, where W7X is, and starting talking to people. And he was wondering, why exactly are we not doing something here? And then he was told, actually, there is a group of people that is getting ready to fundraise. And then it all happened very quickly. We incorporated on January 11th. We signed the term sheet by the end of February. And by April, on April 17th, we had the team move to Munich from Greifswald, different parts of Germany, from Boston and San Francisco. My co-founder Martin joined us from Google X in San Francisco. He was another part of the story. He had been working for 4 years in McLaren Formula One and then 6 years in Google and Google X. He is a terrific engineer and was bringing to the story also a bit of a different mindset. He had been working in a fast-paced engineering environment in industry, so complemented the rest of the initial group. And so then we clicked, and now we are in the deep of it and things are happening very fast.
This is amazing. This is amazing. And I'm just so happy for you and so happy for Europe. And I just Googled the Stellarator VW6. My gosh, what a beast. What a beast. And what
That's
an
amazing.
Yeah, what an interesting device to bring plasma to sustainability levels, right? I guess that's the key here.
It aims to bring matter to incredible conditions. For fusion to become viable, you need to achieve order of 100 million degrees at the center of this plasma. And you need densities as high as possible. And you need to confine this plasma as robustly as possible. Now, the densities that you achieve in a device like this are actually very low. They're like a millionth of the density of air. So that means you very high temperatures, very low densities. Overall, the pressure is of the order of a few atmospheres. The amount of energy in the plasma at any time is actually very small. That's part of why this is extremely safe. But the amount of energy that you can get out is incredible in a Stellarator power plant.
How is entrepreneurship so far, like this roller coaster? And how do you relax? Because you're on a marathon. This journey is going to take you, I don't know what, like 10, 20 years.
Yeah, I try to go running with some regularity. With one of my teammates, Andrea, we've decided to sign up for the Munich half marathon. This was a good idea. And at the same time, it turns out that we actually have to train for it. So we've been getting on with it every Sunday. We do a good long run. And then during the week, I struggle to get the right time. But I think it's important to keep some of that balance. It's an intense journey. To people that ask me, do you get enough sleep? Do you have enough free time? I remind them that it wasn't exactly that when I was in research at the Max Planck at MIT. I wasn't that relaxed either. I mean, the journey of somebody that wants to be high-paced is always being high-paced. As long as you enjoy what you're doing, keeping up long hours, talking to ever more people, should be fun. Right now for us, we're seeing the right trends. We see the results. We have lots of excitement in the team. I'm happy to live this adventure as it is.
Amazing. Amazing. I've heard this quote that this stress from entrepreneurship sometimes can be considered as a privilege, because most of the times probably you are working on something that you believe very, very strongly. There is, of course, a risk, but this stress is a privilege because you get the opportunity to work on something that you really believe in. And also you mentioned something that some investors might come in. Are you fundraising? Should we announce something? Should we say something to the people listening or not yet?
We've just finished a second close of our pre-seed. Okay. We've been looking for the strongest angel investors and new allies, and we're going to make an announcement real soon.
So excited. So excited to see entrepreneurs like you, Francesco. I believe Europe needs more of them. We need more entrepreneurs just overall. So thank you. Thank you very much for all the work that you guys are doing. And thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.